Seattle topped the White Sox 2-1 in 10. The forecast from the National Weather Service, some possibly severe showers and storms could develop later on this afternoon, a high of 88. Clearing skies tonight, a low of 60. Sunny tomorrow, a high of 78. Right now, it's 77. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very excited to be making the acquaintance today with a gentleman by the name of Brian Mulgart. He is in the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Lincoln Park. And it is a book that takes a look at, of course, tumultuous events with which a lot of us are fairly well acquainted, namely the severe social unrest that surrounded that Democratic convention. But he lays it within a context that is far richer and wider than even he probably understood to be the case at the outset.
Yes.
And so the result is a book that is far deeper and wider and broader and fascinating than one might even expect it to be. The book is published by Southern Illinois University Press. And Professor Mulgart, I have been really enjoying your book. It only got into my hands a couple of days ago, so I must confess that my reading is maybe more characterized its opportunity. Tell our listeners about the outset of this project. That is, what prompted you to want to explore?
I would start back. I was a student at SIU, and in my master's program there, I was interested in the 60s. And it was also kind of a fluke. I was a senior, and I was walking down the hall, and Bobby Lieberman spotted me and said, "Hey, I'm doing a graduate seminar on the 60s, and do you want to do it, be part of it as a senior?" And I thought, okay, great. And I took that seminar and came to Chicago in March of 68 and announced to the world that we're coming here in August. And we're going to have a festival of life. And they made these outlandish threats about LSD and the water supply and things like that. And I kind of thought to myself, well, wait a minute. If you're in Chicago and the announcement has been made, you probably realize something is coming and you're going to need to prep for it. So fast forward, we moved to Kenosha, sitting in my little apartment over there. My wife's at the Parkside. I'm doing some adjunct work there. And I've had to be Googling as well. Had you shown up that day, this flyer has phone numbers and contact heard of called the Northside Cooperative Ministry. And I thought, bingo, I have it. Yes, this is evidence that, you know, sort of quote unquote average.
I only mention that to say that it seems to me that it's intriguing in the early 21st century to be looking back over, also a challenge in looking back over that span of time. And in particular, there's maybe not a whole lot of people you can talk to directly all these decades later. What was that challenge like, first of all, to explore something that was not a part of your own life or direct
yeah.
experience, and also
right.
something that happened half a century ago?
Well, I'll pick up. I go to DePaul University and the Special Collections and Archives, and Catherine DeGraff, I think, was there at the time, and she was wonderful. And so I go through this Lincoln Park neighborhood collection thinking it's going to be exclusively about Chicago in 68 and the festival and all that. And instead, most of the documents are about urban renewal. And I'm not an urban historian. So I thought, I've made a mistake. what have I done? A new story on my hands. It's somehow there's this bigger thing called urban renewal and debates about it going on. There's a group called the Lincoln Park Conservation Association. Who are they? Well, they formed in 1954. So now I'm back in time. Okay, did not see this one coming. And they had the first vision for what Lincoln Park should be. And these were a bunch of, well, a group of middle and upper middle class liberal business people in Lincoln Park. And they wanted to promote what they thought was diversity. In the book, I call it cosmetic diversity. Because when they talked diversity, and they talked about it a lot, it was largely kind of European ethnic diversity. And they wanted to, you know, get on board with urban renewal and get federal, state, city funding to develop the neighborhood in their vision. And there's another group called, again, the Northside Cooperative Ministry, some of the ministers were involved in the LPCA, the Conservation Association, and they had a spirited debate in the early 60s about the future of the neighborhood. And so there I'm going, now I'm in religious history, which I also don't do. And that took me to University of Illinois Chicago's campus because they had the Northside Cooperative Ministry collection. So there I am going, okay, what's this? So now I have these ministers on the scene, and now I have this broader story that you're talking
into a situation that is already quite tense, although for, in a sense, different reasons over different issues than were at the heart of what the Yippies were all about. And we'll talk about them in just a second. Your book actually makes reference even earlier than 1954, span of time that we are talking about. And one of the most interesting things you explore early on is the distinction between urban renewal versus urban gentrification, which is not an easy thing to unpack and understand.
Thank you for noting that.
and of course, the fact that sometimes these can overlap, and a certain person can be in some cases engaging in both, maybe even without realizing it, makes it even more complicated.
Exactly.
So, to the best of your ability, help us, the listeners and newcomers to this topic, understand the distinction between urban renewal and urban gentrification, and why that difference or disparity is maybe at the heart of some of the tensions that were already in Lincoln Park before 1968.
Well, first off, thanks for noting how difficult this part is, because it was hard for me. Some deep water there. Urban renewal is a term. You know, it's a government program. It's set in stone that you will work with the government to get funding, and you will sit down with them and say, we're going to do this, we'll knock down this building, we'll plan this way, we'll put this up. Gentrification kind of happens. It's a term coined in the early 1960s. And often the gentrifier is someone who is portrayed as coming from outside, as some kind of invader looking to expel people, often those of low income. And there's some truth to that. And so I looked at them both going, well, they're kind of the same in a way. One's, you know, has a definition, the other just kind of happens. And so I point out in the introduction, this is diversity to me. I want to better my neighborhood. And unfortunately, the end result is going to be gentrification, is that people of low income will be driven out in certain places.
Right. Because as an area becomes just more economically affluent, rent rates go up and so on, and they become out of reach. So help us understand, set the stage, if you would, in terms of 1948 or right around there. What is this neighborhood called Lincoln Park like? And why was there this rising sense that we need to do something about this neighborhood and make it better?
Sure. Discussions about renewal had gone on in various places, including Washington, D.C., as early as the 30s, really. Apartments that people want to deconvert back to homes again. And I do point out that Lincoln Park in many ways was diverse. Diverse occupations, diverse peoples of certain European backgrounds in particular, diverse leisure activities, diverse fear of decay, right? And they call it blight, right? And so they start talking, the Old Town Triangle Association is formed in 1948, and they're talking immediately about what to do in the Old Town section of Lincoln Park, and then others join in. Mid-North and other neighborhoods form their own organizations. In 54, they become this umbrella group, again, the Lincoln Park Conservation Association, and they start working with, as a an umbrella group, the government, state, local, the city hall. Right away, they're tied to city hall. Some of the people in the Lincoln Park Conservation Association have direct at Act 55, and they also have contact with other people. This city architect is actually part of the organization, the LPCA. So right away, they're fused, so to speak, to the levers of power in Chicago, and their voices will be heard.
Part of the power structure.
Exactly,
there.
Exactly.
Which probably helps understand why this, all kinds of different groups spring up in and around this issue. That's one of the things that's really interesting. But one of them, as you've already mentioned, is this Northside Cooperative Ministry.
Mm-hmm.
I think 20 different Northside. What is the distinction there? What were they concerned about in terms of the way things were going? What were they hoping to see happen instead?
Getting at LPCA meetings, you had petitions that were signed. And again, there was cross-enrollment. Some of the ministers were trying to get seats on the executive committee of the LPCA to do it that way. And they were countered. And so it was a spirited debate going back and forth. By 66, it was kind of heating up. And it was
kind of a counterculture presence in Lincoln Park, which you certainly explore in your book in sometimes really colorful fashion. Explain what sort of the Lincoln Park / Chicago version, if you will, of the counterculture sort of looked like and felt like, and what its influence was on some of these events.
Thank you for asking. So I chart the rise of Chicago's counterculture largely in the Old Town area. And Old Town, sometimes they were called hips. Sometimes they like being pointed out in the book. I would say it was the Haight-Ashbury of Chicago. But it was also unique in its own way. It was blended with commerce. You know, you had commercial stores and boutiques in Lincoln Park, four doors down, so to speak, from hip enclaves or apartments. And you had, yes, some high rents, but if you're willing to live communally to offset the price, then you've got a house full of quote-unquote hippies down the block. So you have this burgeoning countercultural scene, and the Chicago Underground magazine Seed. And it started off as basically kind of a hip mag, underground mag, dedicated to music and drugs, basically, free medical aid, what have you. So you see them in Chicago taking some guidance from San Francisco, but they're also doing, cliche about it, doing their own thing, right? They're interacting with business people. And it's going to be some of these countercultural people in Chicago who do the nuts and bolts planning for convention week. They're going to be the ones working with the ministers to file paperwork, to meet with city officials. And this also kind of flies in the face of the stereotype of the tambourine-banging hippie.
Yes.
Is inspiration from San Francisco.
Yeah. When you're talking about this publication called Seed, mm-hmm. and you do, as you already mentioned, quote from it extensively, at one point, either you say, or I think maybe you're quoting somebody who's observing about Seed, that maybe they were guilty of creating a real clean dividing line between the hip and the unhip. And that was just, that kind of leapt out at me, because it does seem to me that's often the way we think about this period in our history as well, that you had all of these people that are sometimes called hippies,
mm-hmm.
and then you have all these other people who
right.
are the opposite, and you just really think of it in kind of binary
right.
terms, and you feel like that's a mistake we're making. Surely it was more complicated than that. But, you know, that moment in your book kind of points to the fact that even in the moment, in this publication called Seed, they were probably, if you will, were guilty, if I can use that term, of this dividing line between hip and unhip.
In the publication, they talk about this, and I would call it a false binary, in their case, between hip and square, right, the business people. And they kind of fight about it in the periodical. Who are there, but within the quote-unquote hip community, there's constant invention and reinvention of who we are.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Brian Mulgart, a professor of history at Millikan University, and the author of a book called Wear Some Armor in Your Hair, Urban Renewal in the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Lincoln Park. It's a book which seeks to set in kind of a wider, richer historical context the events that we all pretty much know about that occurred during that tumultuous 1968 Democratic, that sort of messy stew came the events that, of course, were flashed on television screens all across the country. As we are moving through this period of this neighborhood of Lincoln Park trying to come to terms with...
The hippies are out of New York, Hoffman and Rubin. They're in their apartment on New Year's Eve. They're stoned. And they're talking about, how do we protest the Democrats in August? And they come up with this idea. They said they wanted to blend pot and politics, and they wanted to have a political, you know, demonstration with a concert, kind of like Monterey Pop, you know, in San Francisco. And so they come to Chicago in March and say, Chicago, and they ask for someone to be their point person in the city. And Abe Peck, who is a now well-known journalist for years to come after this, but at the time, he was a hip freak guy in Lincoln Park in Old Town. He answers the ad, and he says, okay, I'm your guy, and we'll pick Lincoln Park as the destination. So now Peck and these ministers and others, like I said, are working with the city, and they don't get the permit. They try all throughout the summer of 68. As I say in the book, if you were in Lincoln Park, Old Town in particular, actually, and you looked hip, you were a police target. Mm. Daley was concerned about violence. Mm. He said, this could be bad, and we want to... No, they're denied, and there were signs up all over Lincoln Park, and I have one in the picture of that in the book, 11 p.m. curfew. And the police never enforced it. But now, as the convention dawns, this is where we pick up with convention week. The officers are ordered to move in, and they're kind of looking at each other. If you look at photographs during the day, the officers are standing around. The title of the book comes in. That in Seed, Abe Peck warned people, if you're coming to Chicago, you know, the song lyric, of course, is, you know, if you're coming to San Francisco, make sure to wear some flowers in your hair. Mm. And Peck wrote in Seed, if you're coming to Chicago, wear some armor in your hair.
The so-called yippies. And I don't remember if you spell this out, but my understanding is, I mean, that they were sometimes known as the Youth International Party.
Yeah.
to maybe give them a veneer of respectability but and stability maybe too. But in fact, it really just came from just an exclamation.
Yes, yes. This is something I still remember when I read it in David Farber's book so many years ago. They're again stoned, and they start saying, yippee, 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 and when they get this idea. And then later, at some point, they say, it comes out that they're the so-called Youth International Party. Yeah,
right.
And anyone could be a yip, which was also kind of frustrating to Chicagoans because Hoffman and Rubin aren't in town. There's no real leadership from on high here.
Right.
And it's just part of their ethos. It's their thing. Do your own thing. And so if you're a Chicagoan, you're trying to figure it out.
You write at one point in a section of the book called Enter Yippie, central to Hoffman and Rubin's protest style and the countercultural movement in general was spontaneity, theatricality, and a lack of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, you're inviting, in the sense, trouble with
yes.
that last part. But what you go on to say is this allowed all participants to be organized, thought it should be.
We're going to need attorneys. Where's a phone number? We're going to need crash pads. Churches at night opened their doors for people to sleep. The Church of the Three Crosses is one that's prominent in the book.
Yes.
And they donated a wonderful picture as well of ministers bringing a cross to a Tuesday night protest. They're opening their doors as well. So now, yes, because there's no real organization in YIP, so to speak, Chicago.
Are trying to kind of launch this event, that there are a lot of ways in which the yippies were characterized, and the thing I read before kind of touches on this, on a relatively lighthearted approach to many of their protests, to be creative, sometimes...
Yep, humorous. Oh, yes.
Yeah, humorous.
Satirical, yes.
Right. And yet, there seems to also be an element of what they did or said or the way in which they were interpreted that really ratchets up the tension and the possibility of violence. You write at this point in this chapter called The Counterculture, unlike past disruptions that in Lincoln Park that consisted of picketing and public outcry, Yippie made direct threats on personal safety, shifting the dynamic of conflict in the neighborhood from verbal disagreements over urban renewal to physical threats to the established...
Kidnap politicians and take them in taxis and dump them out in Wisconsin. They were going to dump LSD in the Chicago water supply. They thought, again, satire had been part of Hoffman and Rubin's approach for a long time. Then they brought that, you know, approach to Chicago, and Mayor Daley was not in on that joke. He took it seriously, and that's...
So interesting. In the moment, one can imagine somebody reacting to this possibility in this way, thinking they are doing the city of Chicago and its citizens a favor by, you know, sort of locking things down and not allowing things to erupt in the way that has been threatened. And yet, it appears to have had really the opposite effect. And if anything, it fermented this tension in some really awful ways.
Yeah, simmer to a boil from July to August is all of a sudden... Yes, people are coming from out of town to be part of the protest, and just sometimes it's just curious Chicagoans who show up, but you've also got these poor officers on double shifts towards the atmosphere. Now, during convention week, you have increasing numbers of Chicagoans, ordinary people, coming out going, wait a minute, okay, they open their doors at night to fleeing protesters. And these protesters, by the way, were firing rocks and bottles at officers, too. And now they're, in some cases, ferrying the wounded to area hospitals. So now, after it simmers down, Yippie flees town. You know, 600-plus, somewhere between 600 and 700 arrests. Now Chicagoans are looking at each other in Lincoln Park going, what next? We didn't think that was going to happen. And then they're still talking about urban renewal.
Right. Where is the neighborhood? I mean, it's sort of a slow crescendo in some respects. Is that mostly happening in Lincoln Park versus the way things sort of move on Wednesday night? Am I understanding
well,
that correctly?
Well, yes. You have Lincoln Park is the center between Saturday, definitely, and Tuesday. Saturday, you know, over the weekend, you have your Yippie hijinks. They have their Pigasus, the nominated pig for president, and they have a concert the MC5 tries to play at, but they get the plug pulled. And the police move in at 11. Saturday, Sunday, not much. You know, they put there's their bonfires out. They just put buckets of water on them. Sunday, you get some violence. Monday, you get even more violence. At night.
And again, in Lincoln Park.
Yes. And again, during the day, people are... they have little fires of cooking hot dogs. They're playing bongos. They're singing. Allen Ginsberg is there at one point chanting Om. And then at night, Monday night, officers show up, and it gets more brutal at that point. And so Tuesday, who has the right?
The world is watching. That's largely in Grant Park, closer to downtown.
Downtown.
And closer to where the actual convention
is
taking place.
Yes, and Wednesday night it had siphoned off to the south. A lot of the protesters in Lincoln Park had gone south to Grant Park.
Right. So, ultimately, the Yippies leave town, the tear gas clears from the air, but not the tension left in its wake. And so then the question is, where do we go from here? And by the way, one issue that we've not yet really talked about all that much is... the sort of the specter of racism just beneath the surface. And of course, as a lot of people, including Martin Luther King found out, some of the most difficult racism to combat is that which is not overt and hood-wearing racism, but racism that is sort of embedded in the decisions you're making and the permits you're granting and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And so we have that. Complicated.
This sashays into confrontation. As I point out in the book, the Young Lords are kids. They've been displaced many times by urban renewal. They don't have training in, you know, civic protests. So when they go to Lincoln Park Conservation Association meetings, they can be quite disruptive, knocking things down, flooding the hall with people chanting disruptive. And
in a way that's kind of shocking to read about.
They occupied churches, and the churches were, by the way, quite supportive of them.
Right.
They were just frustrated, and I found even the some of the Lincoln Park Conservation Association people said, we understand where you're coming from, and you're right. You've been targeted and displaced, but stop doing what you're doing. The takeovers don't officers' addresses of neighborhoods where they thought Yippies would sleep and this kind of thing. And now, as I pointed out earlier, they've been fused to City Hall from day one. Now they're scared by these tactics, they say. They keep saying, oh, we understand you. We get it. But we just can't have this kind of confrontation, the strategy of confrontation, as they called it in the Black Panthers. The young lords, in many ways, patted themselves after the Panthers. And now, I
that as we make our way into 1970,
read of quote unquote revolution. That didn't happen, obviously. But I talked to John Tuttle in particular, but I just couldn't find him. But in other cases, I thought, well, there oral histories have been done. Grand Valley State, for example, and DePaul have young lords' oral history transcripts. So I relied on those instead of direct interviews because I wasn't sure what I would get in those interviews. And I used to work, when I was in grad school, I worked at the University of Connecticut's Center for Oral History. So I'm not against it, but I just thought in this case, and I had clearance for my dissertation to do these interviews, I've got enough written material here, I can use that.
Right. Well, I mean, the book is incredibly rich as it is, so I can scarcely imagine it would probably explode the cover apart if there was even more there. But no, I appreciate all that is there.
Do you
feel like there are particular lessons that can be drawn from the Lincoln Park story, if we want to call it that, particularly when it comes
to them in the civil rights movement? Those folks on their own tried to learn the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee
versus the out-of-towners.
Yeah.
And the locals kind of understanding what's going on the ground, understanding the context, versus those that come from the outside that in a sense don't, and yet maybe bringing something essential exactly because, they're not in a sense part of the system but are coming in as outsiders, sometimes probably with a perspective that might be useful.
Yeah, one of my old Prairie School students years ago, we were going to do a service project, and she very wisely said, when you do service, you ask the people what they need first. You don't tell them. Mm. And in this case, you've got Yippie saying, we're coming, we're doing this. Okay, it was nice of them to put an ad in the paper, and APEC responded. But you need to talk to the people who are boots on the ground and ask them, okay, what do you need?
Mm. Well, all that and more is Urban Renewal and the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Lincoln Park, published by Southern Illinois University Press. And the author, Brian Mulgart, Professor Mulgart, is going to be making a presentation to Adventures in Lifelong Learning tomorrow at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside.
Looking forward to it, yep.
Do you happen to recall the time?
2 p.m.
2 p.m. tomorrow afternoon. And I don't recall if this is a fully open and access event, or if one needs to kind of work through Adventures in Lifelong Learning.
I think it's the latter, but I doubt they turn people away.
Right. But people can seek out Adventures in Lifelong Learning through the website of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, uwp.edu, to get more information. And we hope people will seek that out if they want to hear more from you and this fascinating story. Professor Brian Mulgart, thank you so much for being my guest today on The Morning Show. It was great to talk with you.
I love talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Very, very much my pleasure. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kaylin Palomares will be joining us for her monthly visit to the program. With her will be Dave Giordano from Root Pike Wynn, and they will be talking about the Horlick Dam project in Racine and what is hoped to be gained by the changes that are likely to be made to the Horlick Dam. We'll be talking about that tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org, and we remind you that you can